Thank you, dear listener, for tuning in to Panopticon, a podcast which explores various elements of the occult, culture, and consciousness. And now your host, Andy.
Greetings, and welcome to episode 15 of Panopticon Podcast. Tonight we have Professor William B. Irvine. William is a professor of philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. He is the author of many articles, essays, and books, including, most recently, A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy, and On Desire, Why We Want What We Want, both from Oxford University Press. Good evening, William. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I suppose it's morning where you are, though.
It's an early morning, but a beautiful early morning.
Very well, very well. Now, I wanted to bring you on tonight to talk about this new book that you've written about Stoic philosophy called A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy. But why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself first before we get started?
Well, I'm a professor of philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio, and have had a career, I guess, now nearly three decades long. I started out doing the usual academic stuff, writing technical papers with an interest primarily in gaining tenure and getting promotion. And having been promoted, I started thinking, well, maybe there are other things I can do with my own philosophical interests. And that led me in 2006 to publish a book on human desire. And then, as a kind of a strange sequel to that, in 2008, I published Guide to the Good Life, which is an investigation of Stoic philosophy, and not in the academic sense, an investigation, but just an investigation that asks, can we learn anything important here in the 21st century from the Stoic philosophers, who, of course, were around more than 2,000 years ago.
Okay, fantastic. Well, before we get into what led you to Stoic philosophy, and can you explain to our listeners kind of briefly right here at the outset basically what Stoic philosophy is?
Stoic philosophy is what could broadly be called a philosophy of life. And what a philosophy of life does is it attempts to inform you what in life is most worth possessing, and then secondarily gives you a strategy for gaining the thing that's most worth possessing. And it's one of many philosophies of life in the ancient world. You know, among the philosophers, if you were living in Athens in 300 BC, or if you were in Rome in 100 AD, as a kid, you would have probably, if you were a male, probably, and in your late teen years, you would have gone to a school of philosophy, and it would have provided you with a philosophy of life. And Stoicism was one of the schools you could have gone to. There was the Epicurean school, there was the Academy, there were the Skeptics, there were the Cynics. There were actually a bunch of other less well-known schools of philosophy, and would have given you very important insights into how you live the rest of your life. What is it you should be trying to attain, and how could you best attain it? Now, broadening out from that, there are other non-philosophical philosophies of life. Buddhism, I would say, is better described as a philosophy of life than as a religion. And, of course, there's the Zen component of the Zen sub doctrine of Buddhism. So there are other competing philosophies of life. And, you know, there's a case that you should have one of these. You only have one life to live, and the sooner you figure out what things in life are worth pursuing, the more successful your life is likely to be.
Okay. Now, okay, so you write that, you write about the differences between Zen Buddhism and Stoicism. Were you practicing Zen Buddhism?
No, I've never consciously, I guess, the full-blown practice of Zen Buddhism I have not done, but I did when I was doing my desire research project. I I read first-person accounts of people who practice Zen Buddhism and read as much as I could find on it. But yet it intrigued me, and it seemed to be one way. You know, the problem, the principal obstacle to our happiness is our desires. We human beings are insatiable. When we get what we want, we just go on to want something new and different. So we're no better off than we were before we got what we wanted.
Right.
And Zen Buddhism, to me, seemed to have important insights into how to get out of that predicament. So I was quite interested in Zen for a while. Never did practice it in the full sense of practicing it, though.
Okay, I would definitely want to get more in depth into that issue later on. But what led you to become so taken with this philosophy to write a book, a whole book about it, and you know, such a personal book about it?
Well, I went into the project, the Desire Project. It was I had a hidden agenda. I was going to learn more about Zen Buddhism and ultimately become a practicing Zen Buddhist. And so, you know, I in the background. That's what I'm doing in that book. But in order to get full insight into human desire, I thought I needed to see what all sorts of different thoughtful people have said about human desire. So I did research on, you know, I read a lot of psychological research on it, some neurological research on desire. And I also looked to see what philosophers had to say about desire. And it turned out that that among them were the Stoic philosophers. Biggest surprise was I thought I knew what the Stoics were about. You know, they're just, what should you do? You should fight your emotions and you should become this grim human being who can stand there and take whatever life throws at you. And I discovered, much to my amazement, that everything I knew about Stoicism was wrong. And that's the interesting thing about being an out-of-the-closet Stoic, is when people find out you're a Stoic, they make those assumptions that I used to make about what Stoicism is, and it turns out it's completely the wrong impression. So that was a big surprise, and I also found that, you know, whereas Zen has this ineffability about it, you know, you cannot say what it is you're seeking, or you decrease your chances of attaining the thing you're seeking, and you cannot try to accomplish it, because once you try, that awakens desire. You have all these paradoxes. Whereas Stoicism is pretty straightforward. It says, hey, somebody insulted you today. Here's a technique to try. So I found it refreshing. I found it accessible. I found it very much kind of in tune with my own personality. So the big surprise that came out of the research on desire was I started dabbling with Stoicism and found, to my delight, that it seemed to work quite nicely.
Okay, and who were the principal founders of the Stoic school, as it were?
Zeno of Citium was the founder, and, you know, that needs a little bit of background, because you think of philosophers as these people who live, you know, on the sides of mountains, and then suddenly have a moment of insight and come up with some profound new truth. Whereas if you go back to the ancient world, you know, I mentioned a bit ago that we had all these different competing schools of philosophy. The thing on the current cultural landscape that I think comes closest to it wouldn't be schools or colleges or departments of philosophy, but it would be schools of martial arts. So how do you start a school of martial arts? Well, you open your doors and hope that you're going to attract enough students so you can stay in business. Well, who can start one? Anybody can start one. Well, if you start a school of martial arts, sometimes people will start it on the basis of having trained with some famous martial artist, and they will say, you know, I'm very much learned. I'm certified in karate or whatever. Other people won't take that route. Instead, they'll combine together features of different forms of martial arts and come up with a brand new kind of fighting and hope to attract students.
Right.
Zeno of Citium did approximately that. He borrowed principles from various schools of philosophy, the sorts of things they taught, and blended them together and came up with his own philosophy and began a school of philosophy. Now, he was a Greek and had a very successful school for many years. When Rome rose to power, the Romans were interested in importing all things Greek. You know, they were eager to get Greek culture. And so the various schools of philosophy were exported from Greece to Rome. And Stoicism was one of the schools that made it to Rome that way. And most of the writings of the Greek Stoics, by the way, have been lost, but the Roman Stoics, who are I regard as my principal influences, are easy to find in most bookstores. You can get the writings of people like Seneca, of Marcus Aurelius, of Epictetus. Those would be the three greatest Roman Stoics. And, you know, a lot of people, if you look at the on Amazon, if you look at the ancient philosophy bestseller lists, I mean, these are still bestsellers, you know, 2,000 years later. Marcus Aurelius is always up there. Seneca is always up there. So it's had lasting power.
Well, that, as you mentioned, your original conception of the Stoics were these kind of wooden, immovable men that were not necessarily unhappy, but not necessarily happy, and you kind of realized that it wasn't that wasn't very correct. So, what would be the Stoic ideal of happiness and pleasure, I suppose?
Yeah. Well, the Stoics don't talk in terms of happiness. They don't have a lot to say about happiness. Let me back up here a little bit. The interesting thing is, if you look at Stoicism as a theory, you know, you might come up with certain conclusions about how the Stoics would live their lives. But when you actually look at the Stoics and how they lived their lives, and the Stoics, I would include the three Roman Stoics I just mentioned.
Right.
And there's a fourth, actually, Musonius Rufus, who's less well known. But if you look at how they lived their lives, they seem to have been, rather than grim, dour individuals, they seem to have been upbeat, cheerful even, and seem to have impressed other people by those characteristics. They don't talk a lot about happiness as such, but they seem to have an appreciation for things like delight, of taking delight in your circumstances, taking delight in the world around you. Experiencing joy. So as I point out in my book, the phrase joyful Stoic is not an oxymoron. Most people would take it to be that, but it's because they don't understand what Stoicism is. And they value above all what they refer to as tranquility, which isn't, you know, and that only reinforces this notion of wooden beings, because when you say somebody wants to be tranquil, you imagine somebody who is numb, you know, emotionally numb.
Right.
But for the Stoics, tranquility meant not a kind of emotional numbness, but the absence of negative emotions from your life, negative emotions like anger, fear, anxiety, grief. They had nothing against positive emotions. Now, you know, there are positive emotions that themselves can disrupt your tranquility. So I mentioned joy. There's this other emotion very close to it called elation, where maybe that's over the top, but so they would have concerns about that. As far as pleasure was concerned, they were mistrustful of pleasure, as any thoughtful human being should be, because pleasure has the ability to enslave us. Not only has the ability, but when you look at the world around you, you can easily find examples of human beings who have been enslaved by pleasure, who are living a life not of their choosing because they succumbed to pleasure of certain kinds at some points in the past. So Stoics weren't anti-pleasure. They believed in enjoying life's pleasures, but at the same time, you do so very carefully and you do so at your own risk.
Can you contrast Zen Buddhism and Stoic philosophy?
Yeah, here's another surprise that came out of the research. I mentioned, that a philosophy of life does two things. It tells you what in life is most worth having and tells you how to, it gives you a strategy, a concrete strategy for how to get it. And I discovered that many of the rival philosophies of life agree on what in life is most worth having, and it is that thing I just described as tranquility.
Yeah.
And Buddhists would point to tranquility, and Zen Buddhists would point to tranquility. And then, so then that raises the obvious question, well, if they all agree in the goal, why aren't they all the same philosophy of religion? And the answer is because they have radically different strategies for attaining the goal. Stoic philosophy, in the book I describe in detail the different things you can do to try to get rid of the negative emotions from your life, to try to prevent them, and when they pop up, to try to suppress them, or not suppress them, but extinguish them so they aren't there. One technique is called negative visualization. So one way you can become a happier individual is to learn how to want the things you've already got. Because you know what, you don't have to get them, you already got them, and if you could just appreciate the things you've already got, you'd be a happier camper, as it were. But then the hard question is, and how do you do that? Well, this process of negative visualization, you just imagine not having the things that you have. So you imagine, you may not like your job, but imagine not having it. Your spouse, imagine your spouse running off or dying or whatever. And you go through the various aspects of your life and try to visualize what it would be like to be without them. And it pretty reliably, in myself for sure, and in people I've talked to about this, has a very quick effect of making you appreciate things that you would otherwise take for granted. So, back to your question, how is this different from Zen Buddhism? Well, a Stoic, if you say, okay, if I'm going to be a Stoic, what am I going to have to do? And a Stoic would say, well, you're going to spend some time engaged in this process of negative visualization. If you went to a Zen Buddhist, now, here's the interesting thing. The world is full of different Zen masters who will push different kind of ideas about what you need to do to practice Zen. But in one fairly classic form, they will say, what should you spend your time doing in order to practice Zen Buddhism? And one is you should perform this Zazen meditation where you work at emptying your mind of thoughts. Well, a Stoic would never say to do that. A Stoic would say, no, got other things for you to do. A Zen Buddhist would say, no, it's very important that you learn an understanding of how your mind works and gain some control over what thoughts go into your mind. So it's a radically different strategy for attaining the same goal, the goal being tranquility, the absence of these negative emotions. So another thing to point out, and you mentioned that you had studied these as a religion major, except I would call neither of them a religion, and here's the difference. Religions are primarily concerned with the afterlife, with an afterlife philosophy, and how to have a good afterlife. Philosophies of life are very, very much focused on how to have a better life, your daily life. They're focused with that aspect. And if you said to a Stoic, is there an afterlife? They'd say, who knows? But I'll tell you what, the philosophy we teach can help you in this life, so you're going to end up better off regardless of whether there's an afterlife or not. And then one last thought is that Stoicism is not a religion, but is compatible with many religions. So you could be, you can easily be a Christian and a Stoic at the same time. There's just no incompatibility there.
Okay. So let's get into some of these methods that you talk about. You already kind of touched on negative visualization, which rings loud and clear for me because it's very easy for me to do that. I just took a hot shower a couple hours ago, and I stood there thinking, about how many people in the world couldn't even take a shower, much less a hot one, much less every day. So I think that's very, very, very effective, and also it can be used at any point in time. One question I was thinking of, though, regarding that is, you know, there's also a point where you might go too far and start to not necessarily feel guilty about the fact that you have things better than you could have them, but maybe dwell on that a little bit too much and, you know, feel kind of morose or sad about that all the time. Can you maybe speak to, like, the sort of balance that has to be attained there?
Yeah, and one very quick misunderstanding as soon as you tell people about negative visualization is they assume that if you're a Stoic, you spend the whole day thinking about bad things that can happen to you and worrying about them. But that isn't how it works. You aren't dwelling on bad things. You're contemplating bad things. You aren't doing it all the time. You're doing it for a few seconds, a few times a day, maybe. So when I drive to work, if it's a blue sky day, I like to think about the blue sky. Sky didn't have to be blue, but it is blue, and that's pretty amazing. So these are fleeting thoughts that you have about the things that you have in life that you fail to appreciate. You're just thinking, you know, the thing I've got, I don't necessarily have to have. That includes your health. That includes your ability to swallow. I mean, you could go, it's a very, very, very long list of things if you're a normal human being that you take for granted. But you're right, in a hot shower. We had a week-long power outage in my part of the world 2 years ago.
Yes.
And so hot showers were, you know, a distant memory. You know, you kind of got used to cold showers. And it is important to appreciate things. I mean, a hot shower can be something that you're utterly oblivious to, or it can be one of the most sensual activities in the daily life of a human being. And which of those it's going to be depends on the attitude you take coming to it. You know, here's another interesting connection between Stoicism and Buddhism. You know, the Buddhists practice mindfulness. And mindfulness is simply making sure you're aware of what's going on in your life at that point in time. And Stoicism is very much concerned with the same thing. And one way you can become more mindful about things is to realize that the good things in your life didn't have to be there, could have been absent. And let me throw in one more thought on the hot shower along the lines of Stoicism. The best way to enjoy a hot shower is to get really cold first. So this would be a kind of a more advanced Stoic strategy, but there are these exercises in discomfort. So if you're a Stoic, one of the things you will do is you'll go out of your way to make yourself uncomfortable physically, psychologically. And there's several reasons for that. We can explore those, but the interesting thing is, if you want to enjoy a warm shower, you can magnify many times your enjoyment of it by going out in the cold fall weather or whatever, doing something for a while, you know, getting kind of chilled, coming back in and taking the same shower. It's truly a wonderful experience, not something you're going to take for granted. Yeah, but those are some examples of how a Stoic will approach daily life.
Right, kind of like the key idea here seems kind of maintaining a keen grasp on perspective.
Yeah, appreciate the world. Appreciate what you've got.
Right.
And again, most people, when I say that, say easy enough said, but how do you do it? And this process of negative visualization is one easy way to do it. You know, there are people who are forced to do it, like people whose house gets hit by a tornado, and they walk out alive, right? And you see them standing on the ruins of the house. You know, the TV cameras are there, and you see this person who's tearfully saying, you know, my house is ruined, but he's surrounded by his family members, and he says, but I've still got everything that matters. Well, it's wonderful that he came to that realization. What's sad is that it took a tornado leveling his house for him to realize that. And the Stoics would say, you know, a better way to realize that is just engage in negative visualization. Think about the house you've got. Think about if something happened to the house. You can get yourself to the same level, almost the same level of appreciation without being a victim of a catastrophe.
Okay, okay? Let's talk about what you call insult pacifism, and then also the social hierarchy game.
Okay. Stoics, as I've said, I give you a strategy for attaining and then subsequently maintaining tranquility. And as a result, they were very, they were students of life, and so they looked around themselves at how they lived their lives, how other people lived their lives. They did research on what exactly it was that would disrupt people's tranquility. And they've realized that one of the big disruptors of tranquility is how other people treat us, and in particular, the tendency of other people to insult us. Now, when I tell people that, they say, well, you know, as a kid, I got insulted a lot, but as an adult, it doesn't happen. Well, actually, it does, but as a kid, they were blatant insults. You know, somebody called you fatty or something like that. As an adult, the insults are still there. They're just very clever and very subtle, and you know, you can pick them up when they happen if you're listening for them. And the interesting insight of the Stoics was that it's those little things, those little jibes, social jibes that are administered to us by other people, that are one of the principal things that makes us mad in the course of a day. Your boss treats you poorly, your coworkers, your neighbors, your a clerk in a store, that's one of the principal things that disrupts our tranquility. So the question they then had is there a strategy to avoid getting upset by that? And they concluded that the best way to deal with an insult is with what I call insult pacifism. You respond to an insult by doing nothing at all. You simply carry on as if nothing had been said. Or if you absolutely feel compelled to say something, you engage in self-deprecation. That is, you insult yourself worse than your insulter insulted you. So if somebody insults me in a particular way, points out some character flaw, my likely response is, oh no, really, it's much worse than you're making it out to be. It takes the wind out of the sails of the person who's trying to insult you. I mean, from their point of view, they hit you with their best shot, and then you turn around and hit yourself even harder. Or an alternate to that is to engage in self-deprecating humor, which requires a bit more wit. But you take what they said against you, and you turn it into a joke.
Kind of a Cyrano de Bergerac type of thing.
Yeah. You turn it into a joke at your own expense. Now, in this case, they hit you with your best shot, and they left you laughing. And it really is a quite effective technique. For me now, when insulted, a self-deprecating humor is the default response. Didn't always used to be that way, but it's become that way. Now, the second part of your question was about the social hierarchy game. So Stoics were interested not only in making it look like an insult didn't bother you, but in the insult actually not bothering you. And those are two separate things. You could have somebody who used insult pacifism in response to an insult, but was really just burning up inside, just as angry as could be. And the Stoics would say, well, then he lost the game because his tranquility was upset by this, by the insult. Right. Didn't matter what it looked like on the outside. On the inside is what counts, if tranquility is what you care about. So that raises the new question: how do you preserve your tranquility in the face of an insult? And their answer was: most people are hurt by an insult because the insult because they care what other people think about them. So Stoic strategy is one of the things you need to work on is caring less what other people think. And here's the way I put it in my book. We all play this social hierarchy game. We're evolutionarily programmed to play it, on the savannas of Africa 100,000 years ago. If you had social status, you were first in line for lunch, and you had a greater number of sexual opportunities than those who were at the bottom of the social hierarchy. So they ended up having more kids, and their kids inherited the wiring that made them care about social status. Social status may have been very important on the savannas of Africa 100,000 years ago, but that's no longer the case. You know, if other people don't like you or admire you, they can't take your house. You know, they can't stop you from getting married. We live in a society of laws. These things don't happen. But the programming is still with us. So Stoics said you have to very thoughtfully learn to care less what people think about you. Now here there's some qualifications that come in. You should care very much what some people think about you, and those are the people you've chosen as your mentors. Those are people from whom you're trying to learn how to become a better person. If those people disapprove of what you do, you should care very much. Here's an analogy. If you hire somebody to give you banjo lessons, and that person along the way says your playing is awful, rather than getting offended, you should thank them, because you're paying them precisely to give you that kind of feedback. Right. So you should care what some people say, but then there's a bunch of people who, when they show their disapproval of how you're living your life, you should realize it's because they have different values than you as a Stoic do, and that as a result, their values are probably mistaken. Not that you need to go out of your way to point that out. So what you're doing is, according to their values, not a good thing to do. And okay, that's their opinion. Good enough. And then it can help you ignore the sorts of comments people get. If people criticize the car you drive, well, let's see. That means that individual is a person who judges other people according to what kind of car they drive.
Right.
Not by their personality, not by what they've done in life, not by a number of other things that they could judge them by, but simply it's down to what kind of car they drive.
Right.
Well, if that person disapproves of me, I guess I'm okay with that.
Right.
That person obviously has radically different values than I do. I don't need the approval of that person.
Very well, very well. Are there any other specific kind of psychological practices that we could talk about then? After negative visualization and insult pacifism, are there others that you would like to talk about?
Yeah, there's another one that's very important among the Stoics, and that is when it comes to dealing with everyday life, things will happen, events will occur, and you'll have choices to make and potentially things to worry about. Now, of course, the Stoics were interested in minimizing the amount of anxiety they experience. So one of the things they advise to do is in life, and things happen when you find yourself in difficult circumstances, you need to think very carefully about the parts of those circumstances that you can control and the parts that you can't control. And then there's a third category, the parts you have some control but not complete control over. Here's an example. What do you have control over? Well, you have control over your opinions, you have control over your values, you have control over your characters, you have absolute control over those things. So the Stoics would say you should invest a fair amount of time worrying about those things because you can control them. What don't you have control over? Well, you don't have control over whether the sun rises. So if you spend time worrying about that, you're wasting your time. Considerable extent, you don't have control over what other people think of you. So the Stoics would say, again, it's probably a waste of your time to worry about that. You can't control it. Marcus Aurelius, by the way, has a nice line on that. He said, you can't control whether other people sneer at you, but you can control whether or not you do something deserving of a sneer. So you should focus your attention on not doing things that deserve a sneer. After that, the rest of the world will do what they do. There's that middle category, though, and that's things that you have some but not complete control over, like whether or not you win if you play tennis. So the Stoics there have interesting sub-advice. First of all, they say you should concern yourself with those sorts of things. And if you think about it in daily life, there's a lot of things like that you have some but not complete control over. But they also advise you, as you concern yourself with those things, to internalize your goals with respect to those things. So when it comes to tennis, your goal shouldn't be to win the game. Your goal should be to play as well as you can under the circumstances you find yourself in, because that is something you have complete control over. So you take something that you have marginal control over, and by re-identifying your goals, you turn it into something you have complete control over. So if you play your best and you lose, did you lose in some broader sense? No, your goal was to play your best. You did play your best. Now, somebody might say, you know, that's kind of a mind game. And so I'll throw in here, the Stoics had nothing at all against mind games. Negative visualization, which we talked about a bit ago, is a mind game. It's a way to trick yourself into appreciating things you otherwise wouldn't appreciate. Why do it? Because you'll have a better life. So it's all about psychology. The Stoics, besides being philosophers, were some of the most eminent psychologists of the ancient world. And their insights still apply because human nature hasn't changed in the last 2,000 years.
Right, and you use that analogy of being stuck in a traffic jam. And that you can't control whether or not the traffic's backed up on the road you're on. So rather than getting pissed off about it, you can try to enjoy the situation for what it's worth, because you can't really control whether or not there's too many people on that road at that particular time, or whether or not there's a wreck up ahead, or so on and so forth.
Well, if you spend your time being angry at the other cars, then the situation has succeeded in wrecking your day. I don't know if you can enjoy the situation. You can certainly enjoy aspects of the situation. We talked about the blue sky a minute ago. It's something to think about. You can also spend time thinking on the aspects of the situation you do have control over, like if you're late to an appointment, what can you do to lessen the impact of that? But other than that, to simply be accepting of the circumstances you're in, and then the goal is, given this situation, what is the most I can do? What is the most I can expect to accomplish? So again, you internalize your goal, and you may be stuck there for a long time. But if your goal is to get out and not have it ruin your day, then it can be an opportunity to it can be a kind of a personal success, whereas for many people it's just a bummer. It's just a low point in the day. I do mention in the book this notion of a Stoic test. And a Stoic test is a difficult circumstance that you find yourself in. And again, for most people, it's simply something to be avoided. And if you find yourself in it, something to be angry about. Stoics spend considerable time and energy preparing themselves to handle the sorts of curveballs life throws at them. And a Stoic can actually find himself in a situation where he's a little bit frustrated because he feels he's ready for these things, and yet none ever comes his way. You know, he has the curse of being blessed by an existence that's free of curveballs. So he might actually find himself hoping that he's put in a difficult situation, just to see how he responds. One analogy I use, it's like if you're on a football team and you've been practicing hard all season and the coach has never put you in a game, you want the worst way to be put in a game so you can show your stuff. So a Stoic in a traffic jam might be thinking in terms of, gosh, here's a chance to use the techniques I've been practicing. Here's a chance to see whether I can come through this without getting angry in a foolish way, without worrying about things I have no control over, and might come out of the traffic jam feeling rather good in the sense of having reaffirmed his own ability to practice stoicism. Now, the Stoics said the ultimate test of stoicism is when you die. So, you know, there are people who have good deaths. That is, they die in a graceful manner. There are people who fight, probably pointlessly in some cases, till the last minute and die full of regrets and full of bitterness. But that's one aspect of stoicism. They were concerned about death. I did advise you in your negative visualizations, one of the things to do is periodically contemplate the fact that you don't have to be here, that you could have died, and you're still alive. And just having that thought periodically can make you fill your day with grateful activity that and transform a day that might otherwise have been squandered in boredom.
Okay, has Stoic philosophy evolved since the first century? Are there instances of it coming up later in history by that name? And maybe even to fast forward a whole bunch, do you see Stoic philosophy being exemplified or represented in, say, the modern world or even pop culture?
Well, Stoicism did evolve between the Greeks and the Romans. So the Greeks have a much lower, the idea of tranquility is there, but it's also there's the notion of virtue, and the two are intertwined. When you get to the Roman Stoics, there's substantially less talk of virtue, substantially more talk concerning tranquility. So there's already been that one change. Stoicism used to be, there was a time when if you wanted to be an educated person, this would be before the 20th century, you would have had to learn something about Stoicism. You would have had to read the Stoic philosophers. I went off to college in 1970, and I was a philosophy major. Was never introduced to the Stoics. So one of the things that happened in the 20th century was Stoicism, which had kind of been there ever since the Roman Stoics, really moved into the background. But you would see little outbursts of interest in Stoic philosophy. My analogy, it's like the 17-year locusts, which we have in my part of the world. You know, they're there all the time. They're just down there. They live in the form of grubs, and they eat the roots of trees or whatever. And then every 17 years, they come crawling out and do their mating ritual, whatever it is, and then disappear for another 17 years. That's sort of how it is with Stoicism. You know, it'll kind of burst into a public, the public consciousness for a while, and then kind of fade away again. So Tom Wolfe, the author, came out with a book titled A Man in Full, in which one of the characters just discovers Stoicism and starts behaving stoically. And, you know, when I read the book, the mystery was, how are they ever going to turn this into a movie? And the answer seems to be, well, they didn't, because they couldn't. You know, you can't have movies where somebody is just quoting Stoics. That doesn't play very well. So that would be one example of a Stoic outburst, and that was, I think, in 1998-ish. And then it sort of fades away. Now, all this time, though, you can, like I said, you can go to Amazon, you can look at their bestsellers, and you find the Stoics at the top of the list. So there seems to be this large underground component of Stoics. They're always out there, always kind of thinking in Stoic terms. They just aren't culturally very prominent. Another thing, since writing the book, you know, it's been out for 2 years, and I've gotten quite a bit of email from people, and that there is this phenomenon, I call them congenital Stoics, and these are people who, when they read the book, their response is, well, I already knew this. You're just giving fancy names to the stuff I was already doing. So these are people who figured out Stoicism on their own and we're practicing it in some low-grade kind of way. But, you know, the difference is you could imagine somebody who taught himself how to play tennis, you know, an adequate player, and then go and get some actual lessons, and then you become a much better player. You learn tricks. So a congenital Stoic is probably practicing Stoicism and with some degree of skill. But to read the Stoics, you gain greater insight, and the whole thing starts working better for you than it would otherwise.
Okay. If we could refer to the kind of classic dichotomy between, say, Apollonian and Dionysian, ascetic and ecstatic, kind of Narcissus and Goldman, you know, would you refer to Stoic thought as being more ascetic or more celebratory and ecstatic, or some kind of amalgam of the two that kind of unites them both? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Zeno of Citium first took philosophy under a Cynic philosopher named Crates, and the Cynics were ascetics. They owned the clothes on their back. They lived in the streets. And, you know, they spent their time going up to people and trying to get them to do philosophy. And they were very much anti-pleasure. So Zeno started out. That was the first school he attended. Of course, it wasn't really a school. You'd just follow Crates around the streets and see what he did.
Yeah.
But he decided that that level of asceticism was not for him. And so he came up with, in Stoicism, with this idea that you should take part in the pleasurable things life has to offer. But you should do so very carefully. And you should do so, and let me describe this. First of all, there are some things that they're just too dangerous. If you said to a Stoic, well, you know, here's a glass of here's some crystal meth. The Stoic would say, I'm not going to go anywhere near that stuff because it has the power to enslave you very, very quickly. And I don't want to live my life as a slave of pleasure. But now, suppose something not quite as dramatic as that is offered to him. Suppose somebody offers him a glass of champagne, fine champagne. A cynic would have said, no, I'm not going to drink that. Stoic would say, sure, I'll drink some of your champagne. But while drinking it, would probably engage in negative visualization. Might think to himself, you know, this could be the last time I ever taste champagne, or any other liquid for that matter. So while I'm enjoying this delight that the world has to offer, I'm going to simultaneously be preparing myself for the loss of that source of delight. You know, all the things we take delight in will someday, we will be deprived of them. Either they will go away or we'll die, in which case we can no longer experience them. A Stoic will keep that in mind, so he won't want to be enslaved by pleasure. And he also will be preparing himself for the loss of pleasures. It's a twofold kind of process there. But to enjoy a life while alive, a Stoic would have nothing against that. A cynic would have, a Stoic wouldn't. So he's somewhere in the middle ground, you know, as was Buddha. You know, Buddha tried asceticism, it didn't work, and he had come from life in a palace, and that didn't work for him. So you find some kind of middle path, and that's what the Stoics did.
Okay, very well. Yeah, I was just thinking of the life of the Buddha as well. There was kind of a thesis, antithesis, synthesis sort of thing.
Yeah.
Was there ever any kind of physical practice that the Stoics advanced? Or was it mostly psychological exercises?
They did meditation, but it's utterly unlike Zen meditation. So Seneca describes what he calls the bedtime meditation.
Okay.
So this is as you're falling asleep, you are, or as you're lying there in bed waiting for sleep to come, you could do negative visualization. My own approach is periodically through the day, a few seconds at a time, you look at something you take for granted and think about what it would be like to live without it. But the other thing you do at your bedtime meditation is you think about the day's events. What events disrupted your tranquility? Why did they disrupt your tranquility? Is there something you could have done differently to prevent them from disrupting your tranquility? And you also engage in, you assess your progress as a Stoic. It's a good time to do that as well. But, you know, if you compare that to what a Zen Buddhist would call meditation, it's just utterly different. It's got this analytical component that I think Buddhists would frown on. Another physical thing that Stoics would do, these are, I call them exercises in voluntary discomfort, and I kind of mentioned them before. But they'll go out of their way to make themselves less comfortable. An example would be underdressing slightly for cold weather. Or they'll go out of their way to avoid something that they knew would give them pleasure. Why do that? It really seems like a pointless thing to do. In part because, number one, to ready themselves for the loss of those things. But it's also got a positive side, and that is they will appreciate the warm room they come back to more than they would have otherwise. So there's a physical component, and in the book I describe in my own case, I make a point of doing things I don't want to do that are hard for me to do that will make me physically and or psychologically uncomfortable. So I mentioned at one point taking banjo lessons and giving a banjo recital, which is one of the scariest things I've ever done in my life. And I also row competitively, which provides both physical and psychological discomfort. But, you know, the other sorts of practices, you know, like sitting still for hours on end with an empty mind, Stoics don't do that. If it works for some people, that's wonderful, but a Stoic would say your time is better spent doing other things.
Right. Yeah, I think that's kind of why when I read your essays, it really hit me, because I've done quite a bit of different types of meditation in the past, and I think at the beginning, what attracted me to Eastern forms of meditation maybe was just how paradoxical it was, that it made the least amount of sense to my rational mind. And then I began to realize that it, for me at least, and like you said, if it works for people, then that's great, and I would never want to poo-poo some kind of practice that might work for somebody or has worked for somebody, but it just kind of didn't fit with either my character or my outlook on things or the way that I am. And when I was reading you talk about Stoicism, it kind of seemed to contain the same type of yearning towards this tranquility or equanimity without this really difficult practice for somebody like me of trying to empty my mind and then spend years and years and years trying to attain to this thing called enlightenment that I don't even know if it's necessary for me to attain, I guess, if that makes sense.
The interesting thing, the Zazen exercise where you're attempting to empty your mind of thoughts is worth doing for anybody, because it'll teach you very quickly how little control you have over the contents of your own mind, which is truly a paradox. It's your mind. You should be able to control what ideas come into it. But in fact, the ideas just pop in. So you have powerful subsystems whose job, subconscious subsystems in your brain, whose job it is to put thoughts in your head, and they aren't necessarily the best thoughts to have. So, Stoics never said, try to empty your mind of thoughts just to see what will come back in. They should have. It's a good thing to do. But then again, having done it a few times, I think you get the point. And then the question is, now, is the best thing you can do with your time to keep doing that? And again, I had a similar experience to the one you described. I'm a relentlessly analytical human being. And for somebody to say, turn off the analytical component and do what I say, and it might be years, might be decades. Although, interestingly, in response to stuff that I've written, I've had a Zen Buddhist who say, No, you'll know instantly, but, you know, again, the classical thing is you have that wonderful moment of enlightenment, which is utterly unpredictable when it's going to come, and it's unpredictable if it's going to come. And I'm getting old. I'm running out of time. You know, it would be tragic if it came too late for me, you know. But Stoicism, you'll know within a matter of days whether it's going to work for you or not. That's the beauty of it. There isn't this huge investment that might or might not pay dividends. You know pretty quickly. So that's another thing that attracted me to it. But even, you know, Zen Buddhism, I also will readily agree that somebody doing these things can, in fact, have a greater degree of tranquility in their everyday lives. So I'm not denying that in any way.
Sure, sure.
I just think there's a more direct route if that's what you're after. For me, at any rate, there was a much more direct route. Stoicism, you will never have a moment of enlightenment where all becomes clear to you and so on. What you'll have is a fairly big bag of techniques for attempting to deal with everyday life and to retain your tranquility while doing so. And, you know, that's pretty good. If that's what you can get, that sounds like a pretty good deal. And, again, if you can get it with not a huge investment, I mean, we're not talking years. We're talking days before you get kind of an initial understanding. We're talking months before it becomes, or maybe years, who knows, before it becomes your second nature response. And I told you a while ago that I've now arrived at the stage where for me to engage in self-deprecating humor in response to an insult is now reflexive. It takes a while to get there, but you practice, and then it becomes the natural response.
Right. Well, it's a refreshingly rational system of engaging the world. I think that was the most important thing to me reading about it, is that there's no necessarily esoteric truths, and there's nothing that you can't experience on a day-to-day basis and use as a means of furthering your ability to interact with the world in a more and more fruitful way. But I guess one of my kind of closing questions would be just to be frank, how has practicing this philosophy and kind of using it as a map for living, how has it served you?
Well, it hasn't delivered the goods entirely, so I don't claim to be the most tranquil person on the planet. And some people probably who know me would be startled to even hear me describe myself as tranquil at all. But the inner experience has been that it has done a good job of delivering the goods. I seem to be more appreciative of my life and circumstances than was formerly the case. It's harder to ruin my day, still possible to ruin my day, you know, through insults or whatever. It's substantially harder. And, you know, other ways in which it's affected me, we've talked about dropping out of the social hierarchy game. I seem to have had some success, not complete success, but one of the ways that's affected me is I've become dysfunctional as a consumer. The old stuff that I used to want to buy is simply no longer attractive to me. Malls are wasted on me. I don't understand malls, and I look around and I realize I'm the outlier because everybody's there frantically trying to buy stuff. I don't see anything worth buying, usually, rare exceptions. And that's also been the result of the practice of Stoicism. So I have been, to some extent, transformed as a human being. I worry more about my character than was formerly the case. You know, trying to be more graceful in life, more gracious, I meant to say, in life. Trying to be more courageous when I'm in circumstances that require courage, that's something I didn't used to think about. So it's worked for me, and maybe that's all you can hope for.
Okay, fantastic. Well, if there's nothing else about the topic of Stoic philosophy and your experience with it, I'd like to ask you what's coming down the pike for William Irvine, and, you know, do you have projects going on now, and do you have ones that are coming up in the future?
Well, I always have projects going on. I'd like to do more regarding Stoic advice on insults. But, you know, at any given moment, I follow my interests, and wherever my interests lead me, that's where I go. But nothing nothing concrete yet, no publication dates or anything like that.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time to speak with us about this so very important way of thinking and way of being in the world and means of advancing oneself. I think it's very, in these highly irrational, frenetic times politically and culturally where things are happening so fast and there's so many awful things happening all around us, I think this is an extremely instructive and positive and constructive worldview to at least try out for a while.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I very much enjoyed our conversation.
Absolutely. Well, again, William B. Irvine. The book is A Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy. Buy it. And where should people buy it? Do you just recommend Amazon, or are there better places to get it?
Amazon has as good a price as I know of. So Amazon is an excellent place to get it.
All right. Well, thanks. Thank you so much. And we look forward to anything that comes down the road from you. And yeah, it was a pleasure to speak with you.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Well, there you have it, listeners. Again, we wholeheartedly thank Professor William Irvine for coming on to talk to us about this fantastic book. And we thank you, dear listener, for stopping by and checking it out. And until next time, stay gold and get awesome.